From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the fall of 1992 on MTV. The band R.E.M. had vaulted into superstar status with their previous record, Out of Time. You know the big hits from that album, Shiny Happy People, Losing My Religion. As band members have said over the years, suddenly they went from a kind of cult status to the level of Madonna. So when their next record dropped in October of 1992, there was tremendous anticipation. But R.E.M. was not here to satisfy their label or management or to take the easy way to selling millions of copies. When MTV asked them what song they would like to play to launch the new album, they chose the one you just heard, Drive. And Michael Stipe has admitted they chose the song that was least likely to be an easy hit on MTV. They had that power and they were going to make a statement. And in many ways, Drive was the perfect choice to introduce this new album called Automatic for the People. It was dark. Michael Stipe says he was surrounded by death at the time, and he chose to explore death in many ways on the album. Parents, childhood vanishing, depression, teenage pain, and suicide. You might have heard Michael Stipe and Mike Mills on NPR recently discussing this album at 25 years old. We thought it presented an opportunity to discuss not only compelling and meaningful music, but also the risks that artists take and how the media system tends to occasionally prevent artists in various forms, especially music, from taking risks. Our guest this hour includes Sabi Reyes-Kulkarni, a music journalist with Pitchfork, Spin, Billboard, The Democrat and Chronicle, and more. Sabi, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And here is Tommy Mock, who is, among many things, an R.E.M., a big R.E.M. fan.
Thank you.
And shaved his head bald just in honor of Michael Stipe. I'm just kidding.
I wish that was the case.
No, great to have you. Thank you for being here, Tommy.
Thank you.
I started with Drive. I could have gone in a lot of different directions there, but I thought it was interesting, Sabi, that Michael Stipe said on NPR recently that, yeah, that, you know, they knew that wasn't an easy sort of hit, but this was not about taking your launch to fame in 1991 and turning it into easy bubblegum pop, was it?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. There is a new 25th anniversary reissue deluxe package edition of this record that was just out on Friday. And in the new liner notes, guitarist Peter Buck is quoted as saying, "We were trying to become a non-rock and roll band." So when you talked about risk, that's the thing that really stands out the most to me about this album. They hadn't toured prior on their biggest record to that point, Out of Time. And here they come with a bunch of down-tempo, mostly acoustic, mostly without drums tunes that really, I'm figuring, would have put the people who supported their early career in a tough spot.
Is there one, Tommy, that stands out on this album for you more than others?
I would have to say probably it is The Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight. It's probably the most, you know, upbeat of all the songs, and even they have said that they kind of put that in there as kind of the filler song to kind of
uplift
it.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's also one of the songs that is most commonly misquoted. As opposed to...
You mean the chorus, then?
The chorus, yes.
What is he saying in the chorus, by the way? Call me when you try to wake her up?
No, it's calling to wake her up. But a lot of people misquote it as calling Jamaica.
Yeah, that's what I always... I raised my hand. I always thought it was... And I was like, that can't be something about Jamaica. It's one of those classic cases of a song where people have frequently mistaken the lyrics.
I do that all the time, though. I thought that the chorus of Rock Me Amadeus was Rock Me Hot Potatoes for years. So you don't want to ask me. But it's interesting. Michael Stipe in the NPR interview did say he wasn't a huge fan of that one, but the band liked it because it was sort of that counterpoint. Because it's a dark album, otherwise.
It is a very dark album. And I think what it is it's a kind of a self-indulgent album, if you will, because they were at this very high level of what they've achieved with Out of Time, and so they pretty much were saying, you know what, we're gonna write for ourselves at this point. But
isn't that good? No, isn't that better than a producer coming in saying, well, can you simplify this a little? Can you give me a 3-chord hook?
Well, no, that's fantastic if you have the ability to do that. But you got to understand, too, is we were also in a transition musically coming from the 80s with, you know, glam rock and arena rock and mm-hmm. everything, where mm-hmm. everything was pretty much cookie cutter and it's about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Whereas now we are now on the cusp of this singer-songwriter genre that where we had, you know, R.E.M., who was able to write more songs with more deeper narratives that people were actually at the time looking for, because even with the grunge era, we were listening to songs that were hard-hitting and punchy, but the lyrics actually had meaning other than sex, drugs, and rock and roll and partying all night and stuff like that.
So do you agree? What do you think?
I do agree with that. I think it's interesting that here's a band who, although they haven't come out and admitted it, and I don't think they did it in a very obtuse way, they were, it seems from what you can piece together, that they were somewhat trying to undercut their success and yet hit another home run.
that's the interesting thing is, I mean, it was certainly a risk if you just want to talk about selling records, because a song like Drive, which is, you know, it certainly has a dark tone. Maybe it fits in with that changing musical era that Tommy points to, but it's not the easy hit that Shiny Happy People was a year
certainly
and a half
not.
Earlier. And if you want to think about R.E.M. and how cheeky they were, I never knew the story of the song Stand until recently getting ready for the show. I mean, you remember Stand? You want to listen to part of Stand? Everybody remembers Stand from 1989. So Michael Stipe and Mike Mills have explained that, you know, they were sitting around in like 88 and they're recording this record in Green, and they think like, what are the dumbest, easiest pop bubblegum hits in the last three decades? And like, what would that sound like for us? What's the dumbest thing I could write? What's the most, and this is a song about human beings basically barely being able to be functional human beings, being congratulated for standing up and walking. And it becomes a hit. I mean, they were sort of cheeky about it, which I kind of appreciate in retrospect now, Sabi.
Sure, sure. There's a story like that on this album, too, which I think, just to back up to what you were saying before,
yeah.
Senior Rolling Stone writer David Frick described this Automatic for the People. In writing about it, he said, it seems to move at an agonizing crawl.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times, at the time that the album came out, also noted how down tempo it was, how very few of the songs have any kind of upbeat aspect to them at all. But I think what's lost with the lyrical subject matter that you were talking about, again, the New York Times Review described it as disenchanted, talked a lot about how here's a band that was making a transition into adulthood, into their 30s, but they're in a profession where that transition occurs a lot differently for people who are on the road all the time and living that lifestyle as it would for the rest of us. Somehow they were able to turn that into something people could relate to. But again, what's been revealed with this new deluxe package, the album actually started out with much more playful origins. They were bass player Mike Mills, guitarist Peter Buck, and drummer Bill Berry were sitting around in their rehearsal space trading instruments, very casually trying to break free from the molds that they felt they were in on their own instruments. And the song Man on the Moon, what became Man on the Moon, started. Bill Berry, the drummer, was playing acoustic guitar. He reached over for a beer, switched chords from a C to a D accidentally, and Peter Buck runs in the room and says, that's great, I want you to do that. So it's a little misleading to think that what we heard in the end result is it wasn't all dour and gloom in the process of making the record.
Yeah, that story is, I love that story, and you're hearing a little bit of Man in the Moon underneath this here. First of all, just on the song itself, Sabi, is it a great song to you?
Absolutely. And what's interesting is it's one of those songs that you couldn't escape from at the time. Like a lot of the singles on this record, they were like everywhere. It's almost like raining R.E.M. songs on you all the time whenever you left the house. But listening to the whole thing as one entire work, I've gained a new appreciation for songs that I took for granted and was like, whatever.
Why is that though?
Because the one thing I would say is John Paul Jones's string arrangements which I had never noticed when these songs were all over MTV and the radio and the mall and wherever you, where else you went. John Paul Jones, bass player of Led Zeppelin, who has many other skills, but they give the songs a lift without being intrusive. They're not the central focus. They're very, just a simple touch of elegance. And also when you're going into a song like this that you've heard a million times from another song that you're not as familiar with, you're approaching something from a new angle, like going into a city or something that you're getting a new view on it. You're like, oh wow, I never noticed this view. That's what it feels like to me with all these singles.
So, Tommy, how do you feel about this? I mean, Michael Stipe said that when, as Sabi relates, when they got the music, they kind of gave him the music, but he liked the music so much. He said, I don't really know that we need lyrics for this. Like, let's just do this instrumental. He said, no, we're going to need something. And he said he walked with it for blocks with it in his Walkman, if we all remember Walkmans.
Love them. Yep.
And for our younger listeners, the Walkman is, I'm just kidding. But Michael Stipe walked around with the music for this in his Walkman, and he was thinking about Andy Kaufman and why he admired Andy Kaufman so much and some of the various other themes they kind of looped into this song here. What's the end result for you? How does this one rank for you?
It's actually one of those songs you can't get out of your head. And regardless of what musical genre you really like, it's one of those songs that pops in your head and you can't help but sing with it. You can't help but sing the chorus and listen to the hook and just enjoy it. Because it's a great song, but it's also one of those songs that bring you back to a different time. You know, whenever I hear that song, I automatically think Jim Carrey as Andy Kaufman, but it has to rank up there probably with maybe one of my top five REM songs, because it's one of those feel good songs, even though those people who know what Andy Kaufman's history and his comedy and how it was just kind of sporadic and all over the place, it's definitely one of their better songs in my opinion.
Sabi, as a music writer and a music journalist, I think it's interesting and important to point out for the audience that last time Sabi was here, he talked about how you have a little bit of a different view of music criticism or evaluating music as a writer. Fair?
I'd say it's more than a little.
Okay.
It's diametrically opposed to what the conventional notion of what the role of someone doing that should be.
Yeah, so some critics are sort of the anointers that, here's how many stars for this album or what's the score for this. I know you don't necessarily view it that way, but I do want to ask you just in terms of how you evaluate music. Michael Stipe's voice in particular, and I think about Man on the Moon, it's not this... It's the anti-James Taylor, who's never missed a note, is pure as the day is long. Stipe is, his voice will flicker sort of at times.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I always found that sort of endearing and authentic. It's certainly unmistakable, but how do you take it as a writer, as a journalist?
Well, it's like you said, it's unmistakable. And I think Michael Stipe is the classic case of someone who, if you don't like the vocals, you're going to have a really hard time getting down with the music as a whole. But I think what's interesting about him is if you compare Michael Stipe to, say, Geddy Lee from Rush, where the thing you hear all the time is, I like the music, but I just can't get around that voice. It's not so much his voice, because I think his voice has this inherent quality. I call it like a big sky. Whenever I think of Michael Stipe's voice, I think of a big sky. You can get under it, and somehow he makes whatever he's singing about feel relatable. And as accessible as just looking at a sunset or something. But he has a phrasing that's slightly, like you're saying, unorthodox, slightly quirky. So that's how I would, you have to be able to get behind Michael Stipe to some degree to be able to relate to REM, I think, or to respond to REM.
I want to get a couple of comments from listeners in. Andrew writes to me and says, I can't believe you're talking about Automatic for the People and you haven't mentioned Everybody Hurts yet. I know for a fact that it saved a friend's life.
Well, that's the song that, to me, when I was listening to the whole thing in preparing for this show, he really delivers that sentiment. I had always dismissed that song as kind of a sappy ballad until I really sat down and listened to it, and he gets the point across.
Let's listen for a second.
Just yours alone. When you're sure you've had enough of this life, well, hang on. Don't let yourself go.
So you've changed your mind on this one.
Definitely. I mean, and think about that. If you were to write a poem in like a poetry class or something, and you just wrote Everybody Hurts, you would immediately, your instinct would be like, eh, that's a little trite. That's a little too direct. That's sappy, right? But it works there.
And here's one interesting point, because I don't know if Sabi knows this, but Peter Buck has said about this song, it was intentionally simple and direct because they were trying to write it for high school students. So here's what Peter Buck said, quote, "The reason the lyrics are so atypically straightforward is because it was aimed at teenagers." And he said, "I've never watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but the idea that high school is a portal to hell seems pretty realistic to me." And then in 2005, he told the BBC, "If you are consciously writing for someone who hasn't even been to college or is pretty young, it might be nice to be very direct. And in that regard, it is tended to work for people on of a lot of ages, including the very young." So, you know, it lines right up with what you're saying there. It is direct. It's simple.
And but his delivery is so convincing. It's again, if you hear this song like in a supermarket or something, it might sound a little sort of theatrical, but listening to it with headphones, I just felt it was very naked and made me feel like, yeah, everybody hurts. And the power of that sentiment of just stopping and reflecting about that.
And I'll ask Tommy for his thoughts in a second. Let's listen a little bit more with the sound up. This is a song directing someone who's right on the edge thinking about suicide to think about that. So let's listen. Tommy, thoughts on this one here?
This song actually does have a kind of soft spot in my heart. This song came out my sophomore year of high school, and to actually have something that's been, you know, put out directly to, say, the high school thought, the high school collective, it did. You know, I was, still am, the original MTV generation, and when you growing up in, say, the AIDS era and whatnot, and feeling like the world is crashing down around you, and when you have somebody basically telling you something other than what your parents are telling you, that, you know what, it's okay to hurt, it's okay to be good, it's okay to be bad, it's okay to feel down, but just know that you're not the only one that's going through it yourself. And just like the texter had said, you know, he knew somebody that this song actually talked them off the ledge. And I was one of those kids that got talked off the ledge by the words of another, by Michael Stipe.
Wow, you internalized it exactly as the band maybe wanted to. And, you know, so here's Paul on Twitter. He says, "I think songs about self-worth and suicide prevention serve the greater good, like this one." And I think we've got a clip of Michael Stipe talking to NPR's All Songs Considered last month about this. I want to listen to what Michael Stipe says now about exactly what Tommy just described. Let's listen.
The number of times that people have said, you saved my life, or the song was there at a time when I really needed it, thank you. And that, you know, that's my Academy Award. That's bigger and better than anything anyone could say to me, is that something that we did had a positive impact on their life in a moment of great need or a moment when they needed something like that. It was there. So that makes me really happy.
Wow, Tommy. I mean, that's it's strong. And the more I listen to the song in the context of writing for a high school cohort, the more I think it's exactly what it probably needed to be.
And believe it or not, during that time, there was a lot of, you know, things going on in people's minds, and that's a song that is very, that could be used today.
I imagine it is in campaigns.
Yes,
today.
But I would say, you know, unfortunately, the song also has been used in kind of negative. You know, it's like, oh, this is the song that actually makes me, you know, want to harm myself because it's so down. But taking it for what it's worth and what it was meant for and what it was intentional for, I believe that the youth of today can definitely benefit from this song. If they actually just take the time to sit down and listen to it, you got a whole new generation of people that could actually somewhat find solace in it and maybe even be healed by it in a sense.
Yeah, he's saying directly, hold on.
Yep.
You know, so I understand what you're saying. I mean, anybody can twist something, but this song, it's pretty direct.
Yes.
He's saying, hold on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody goes through this and you can hold on. And Sabi, when it comes to, you know, your view as a music journalist, does it matter to you the motivation? I mean, a song like this lands with a population and it saves lives. If they're cynically going out there to try to make money or sell a bunch of records, does that matter to you? Or, you know, it sounds to me like the band very sincerely had a desire to put out something helpful here. I mean, how much does motivation factor into how you evaluate how something is written?
Quite a bit. I usually don't like to know the motivation beforehand. I like to know as little as possible before sitting down with something, and then just, I don't like even like to know the number of tracks or which songs are on it, or if it's an old record I'm already familiar with, I'll like to listen, not looking at the track listing, just so I can be surprised again. But it matters quite a bit. I think that intention comes through in people's work. It comes through differently to different people, though. And then I think also sometimes you can have a very sincere intention and maybe overplay your hand with that. And then sometimes you can have a pretty kind of cynical or almost ironic intention and still connect with people. So there's a certain point at which intent matters, but once the music connects with someone else, they're going to get whatever they're going to get out of it. And so there, I mean, how many times have we all loved a song only to find out that the artist is like, oh, that's my least favorite song on the record.
And you're
like,
don't ruin this for me, man.
Right, so I have a saying, you know, these people are the least qualified to talk about the value of what they made, because what they made lives in your life, not differently than it does in their lives.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And Tommy talking about how the song Everybody Hurts impacted his life. What is it like for you hearing Michael Stipe today talking about that? Because you're in that group. I mean, he's talking about you.
You know, it's almost as if he is actually talking to me. And to be perfectly honest with you, it's refreshing to know that he knows that he's had impact so many lives, and he's grateful. He's actually humbled by it, you know. And I would have to say it's nice to know, if you will. But just like, you know, Sabi was saying, I'm a firm believer in art is, in any way, shape, or form, whether it be musically, a painting, written word. It's for the people to have a reaction to it. It's what feelings you stir from it. You know, even though that there may be a certain intention that that the artist wanted you to have, but his intention may not move me the way that my own feelings, you know, are interpreting the words or the vision that I'm bestowing, if you will.
And I just wanted to clarify, it is extremely satisfying when you connect to a song or an album deeply and you find out that there was something running through the artist that's on the same frequency as what you're experiencing.
Sure.
And it's not necessarily as obvious as it is in this case or as direct as we're saying, but when there's an undercurrent, like an emotional undercurrent, and you're like, wow, that is somehow I was picking up on that. That's a fantastic feeling.
Yeah, there is a song that I'll share in the second half hour about one of my favorite songs on the record that the initial explanation for the song was not at all what I experienced out of the song, though the more modern explanations line up a little more closely. So I don't know if it's revisionist history. We'll get to that. I've got some of your emails that we will read. We're talking 25 years since the release of REM's Automatic for the People, which was a landmark record in 1992. And if you can believe it, it's been 25 years. The band's not getting back together. They said they're pretty much done as an entity, that they feel good about what they did. No plans for a reunion. But they talked recently at NPR, and we thought, given all the themes that came with Automatic for the People, from suicide prevention to, you know, sort of counterculture to going against the grain and taking risks as artists, there was a lot to talk about. So our guest for the hour, Sabi Reyes-Kulkarni, a music journalist with a number of publications, the DNC and others locally, Pitchfork, Spin, Billboard, is, I think, one of the better music communicators I have met here in studio. So it's always a treat to have Sabi here. Tommy Mock is an REM fan. And let's get our only break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about what put REM in this position in the first place, and if the music journalist in the room thinks that there's, I don't know if there's something wrong with that, but does it require power in art to then be able to take risks? In other words, are too many artists pushed into safe choices instead of being sort of who they want to be? And does it take a monster hit before you are in position to take, you know, what people would call risks or demonstrate more of yourself? So we'll talk about that with Sabi and Tommy and listen to some more off Automatic when we come back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Republicans released their new tax plan earlier this month, and it would make major changes to the tax code. How would it impact you if passed? We're going to break it down. Talk to Congressman Tom Reed as well about that. Then in our second hour, what can hospitals learn from the airline industry? Pilot and author John Nance says they can improve their quality of care and reduce medical mistakes if, well, he'll explain. That's all Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It was this hit that was probably what put REM in the stratosphere in 1991, Losing My Religion, which came off of the album Out of Time, which is not, by the way, a song about religion. It's a song about unrequited relationships, but a massive hit, obviously. So you had this one, big hit that you heard everywhere you went, and you also had the song that we opened last hour with, which was this one, which you heard everywhere. Shiny, happy people. In fact, Michael Stipe taught a generation of people how they not to dance in his SNL appearance with this song. But no, this was a song that wasn't quite in the way that they were cheeky with Stand. But Michael Stipe would say later that it was a very straightforward song written sort of for children, and that if you were to send something into space to sell other civilizations about what REM was all about, this would be about the last song that they would choose. Sabi, is this a great song? Is this a bad song? Is this a mistake? Is this just, you know, sort of part of the oeuvre with that they would like to forget? How do you view this one?
Who am I to say?
And I keep asking you that, but how do you feel about it?
And it proves my point. They have a certain take on it, and then
the public has a take on it.
Right, and then people
like
turn it into something else.
I remember David Spade, a comedian from a past life, I think he's probably still alive, who in the 1990s, he said, I went to see REM play, and they were like, we're gonna do a bunch of new songs and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I didn't pay $65 for this ticket to hear new songs, buddy. Play Shiny Happy People and get it over with.
Well, I think the way I look at this song, it's a really good example of how you can get away with what appears to be tossing a tune off, like, off the cuff and making it intentionally twee or sugary, and maybe sneaking your own essence into it. Because they wouldn't have put it out if it betrayed what they were, right? So you hear trademark REM elements in the tune. I think their initial take on it was, let's just try and write like as poppy a tune as we can. And then they did it, and they probably ended up liking the song, is what I'm guessing, enough to see it through. I don't think it was just this like cruel experiment on the public.
You know, maybe they just got sick of it.
Or at the public's expense. But I think you can approach a tune. I think you can approach songs from different frames, where sometimes you're not that serious about it, and you end up with something that you choose to craft into something really serious.
Tommy, how do you feel about this one?
Well, when they take a song and they appear on Sesame Street and call it Shiny Happy Monsters.
That was cool, though.
That, right. And the thing is that in itself is, it's a Sesame Street song, but it's a happy, feel-good, bouncy song. But I honestly believe that it's... It was good for the time,
mm-hmm.
But you back in the day, you had to listen to an alternative station in order to actually get Shiny Happy People. But, you know, not exactly one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
But for Sesame Street, fantastic.
Absolutely.
I wish they put the Sesame Street version out.
As the parent of a young child who likes pop radio, I like songs like this. I mean... We learned last month with Ed Sheeran's new single that he has dropped any pretense of creative impulse, and he is just here to cash the checks with that, with his new song, Perfect. I'm sorry, Sabi, if that was too much of a critical comment.
No, I mean,
that song Perfect is offensive. That is like check cashing machine pablum, is what that is.
Right, and you can feel, and you're saying you can feel the cynicism and the
lack of authenticity.
Like, hey, I want my check. You know, you can feel the cashing in aspect. But I think pop music has so many great examples of songs that were written to be check cashing and still somehow have something that an individual can look at and say, no, there's something else there.
Okay, well, and I'm sure there are people who Ed Sheeran's new song, Perfect, probably lands really beautifully.
I'm not nominating that song. I'm just saying.
We wouldn't deign to nominate that one. But the reason I contrast is, if you're going to, you know, write something sort of poppy, silly, fun, great. Because I've got a kid, and he would love Shiny Happy People. He loves, you know, songs like Happy. That's fine. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, I'm crazy about that song.
Yeah, I think they certainly have a point. Absolutely. I've got no problem with that. It's just that REM looks back and they say, they're kind of with Tommy, that this is not at the top of their list, whereas maybe Losing My Religion's got a higher place. That launches them to success.
But see, I wonder, what were they expecting?
If you're gonna do Shiny Happy People.
It's almost like Watch What You Wish For, or, you know, if you play with fire, you're going to get burned. If you're like, yeah, let's throw out the most, you know, poppy, sugary tune we can. Well, it might just do what you think.
It did with Stand a few years earlier. It did with Shiny Happy People at an even bigger level. And then all of a sudden, they come out in 92, and maybe that was the setup, because 92, Automatic for the People drops, and it was darker, as we've been working through here. So let me ask both of our guests, and then we'll listen to a little bit more music from the album. Take more of your comments here. And Sabi, I don't know if you agree with the construct that I put out there, but my concern, especially in popular music, but in art in general, is that it gets to a point where it's easier to be safe, and real creativity is riskier. Sometimes it's harder to understand, and it's only the people in power, or often it's the people in power who have the ability to make that choice to say, we're going to drop Drive first, even if MTV probably would have preferred Tommy's favorite from the album, which was your favorite?
Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight.
Maybe they would have preferred something like that. Or Man on the Moon, which is the biggest hit from the album. But no, they're dropping Drive first, and, you know, and who cares? And I'm sure there was somebody from the label who came in and was like, this is a little on the dark side. Is there a concern that you have as a journalist wanting creativity that, you know, that it's the artists in power who've got the chance to do that more often?
I wouldn't say there's a concern. Okay. But I would say that I notice definitely what you're talking about. And it is a conundrum, because if you're going to pull a move like this early in your career, you're risking derailing your career for good. I feel like REM were in a position where they knew that there was only so much damage they could do, right? I mean, let's say this record had even tanked. It probably wasn't going to 86 there. It wasn't going to be the end of the line for them, right? We like to see people who take chances and expand. I feel like it's a bit of a Faustian bargain. The more success you have, the more you can become trapped in that success. I feel like independent artists or artists who don't have as much to lose necessarily are more prone to just express themselves versus people who get into the position that REM was in. There's I would imagine, lots of pressure to follow up on success with whatever got you that success. So it's not necessarily something that concerns me, because I feel like even people who aren't successful at this level can play it safe by just repeating the same style that they became known for once people take an interest in them at all. But I do think it's a little bit of a double-edged sword because REM were in a position, as Tommy said, that they could afford to do this. But I think the fact that they could afford to do it is what makes it so admirable in this case. For me, that's what really impressed me when I sat and listened to this record all the way through. It's like this took a lot of guts to think that, you know, I mean, the record doesn't even really get going until about four or five songs into it. It doesn't really and never really like picks up very much, right?
Not much of a crescendo.
Right, definitely not. And it's a long sort of it's a long setup to not really end up feeling like you're necessarily right. Going anywhere. But I feel like those are the records that often end up really rewarding people over time.
It's also the kind of record there. I can't think of too many records I want to listen to all the way through. And this is one that I'm happy to listen to all the way through.
And here's the other thing, too, that I think with this whole issue of taking risks, I think this record should have put both music industry people and anybody who's trying to pursue a career in music on notice now that sometimes you can only get successful by following your heart. In other words, you couldn't have calculated a move like this. Who knows what would have happened had they tried to repeat out of time. It may not have worked. So there's always, I think people who, the people who are like making money from, or looking to make money, should always keep it in the back of their mind. You can't bottle this stuff. As much as you try, you can't reverse engineer what the formula is going to be for success. You can try, but very often the people who throw the rules out the window are the ones who end up striking gold.
I think that's such a great point. So Tommy, when you look at this kind of an album, do you feel like it was the product more of the time? I think you had a wise observation about where music was moving earlier, so maybe that also made it a little more palatable for either a label or the public. But do you think there's also a lesson for those of us who want creative music that, as Sabi said, you know, you can't just force a formula in a studio?
Right, and it is. It was a for the time, and REM as a whole, they're smart people. They knew where they were going, and they knew what to expect. Well, I shouldn't say they knew what to expect from the album, but they knew what they wanted to put out, and they had the power to do that. And being with a musical shift that we were coming from, you know, the hair metal and the those, you know, basically cookie cutters, you know, whereas we were now starting to honor and look at something more of substance from singer-songwriters, you know, like, you know, Sarah McLachlan and Andy DeFranco and just different singer-songwriters out there that were just starting to come up and have more of a say. It was their time. It was their time to come out with something more meaningful, more of an aspect of their of a more narrative song as opposed to shiny happy people, and they wanted to say something, and they definitely did.
Yeah, no doubt about it, they did. One of my favorite songs on the album is a song that almost had a different name. The original version of the story I heard, and I'm going to butcher it a little bit, so you probably should Google it and don't trust me fully on this, but Michael Stipe was writing about you know, sort of the loneliness and the introspection that happens in the overnight hours. And they had hired a night watchman, I think down in Athens, Georgia. And but it turns out the night watchman that they hired was a little on the kooky side, kind of a conspiracy theorist who would see monsters in the dark and run her off with the flashlight and tell them all these things that were. And so eventually they were going to call the song Night Watchman, not Night Swimming. But he thought, I'm not really sure I want this guy coming after me. And it evolved to be a song more about thinking about sort of those fleeting moments of childhood, the beauty of childhood, the beauty of those moments. Maybe, as he said, you're high or stoned and you're swimming at night and all your clothes are on the shore. Listen to the austerity of the music. You know, you've got strings, piano, and voice. That's it. As Sabi said earlier, and Tommy were making the point, listen to the austerity here.
On the dashboard, taken years ago, turned around backwards so the windshield shows. Every street light reveals a picture in reverse. Still, it's so much clearer. I forgot my shirt at the water's edge. The moon is low tonight.
How's this one sit with you, Tommy, for the album?
So, it's... You ever open up an old photo album and you look at old pictures of yourself and you're kind of just like, wow, I remember that time. That was a good time. Or, oh, God, I can't believe I still have that picture. That's what this song is. It takes you back, and even you just sit there and you think, and it just brings you back to that moment, and you can just listen to it. It's even like, what's the song, 1975 by the Smashing Pumpkins. It's kind of the same kind of vein where it just brings you back to a simpler time, and it's a very simple song, but it just brings you back to a simpler time, and that puts a smile on your face. And that's where it sits for me.
Sabi?
Well, I'm still listening to it.
I know.
You know, again, it's deceptive, the song. This was one of the singles, correct?
Yep, it was.
Yeah. Right. One of six singles, which is astounding to think about.
Yeah.
That half the album was released as singles. So, again, I would suggest that if you have a preconceived notion about this song one way or the other, as just a single or as just a song that that's just sort of become part of the landscape, to listen to it in the flow of everything that leads up to it, because it's the second to last tune on the album. And I think one thing we didn't talk about quite as much on the about this record is, yeah, they may have been trying to subvert their image or their identity as a rock band, but they put a lot of effort into crafting these arrangements that are pretty exquisite in my book.
Oh, fantastic. No, they're utterly fantastic.
And very detailed,
mm-hmm.
Very subtle. This is definitely a headphones record. And even that song, which works, you could see that at like a wedding party, right? You can see somebody mm-hmm. playing that when the father is dancing with the bride, mm-hmm. right? You can see it in moments like that that are really melodramatic or whatever. But listen to it with headphones. There's a lot there.
Ed Sheeran moments is what you're saying.
Well, I believe you had mentioned that this is an album that you can listen to from track to track all the way through and not skip over anything. That's what I refer to as the perfect album. When you can listen to the whole thing all the way through and not skip a track, because each song just increasingly gives you something more than the last. And that's how I feel about very few albums these days. Is yeah. you can't really, you know, have a perfect album anymore.
Well, it's hard. That was hard. That's a Herculean task for anybody to do in any time period. You were talking about the concern of risk. I think my concern is mainly on the other side of the equation. We put artists we love in an impossible position because we want them to give us more of what we liked about them, but take just enough chances that they're going to keep us engaged. But don't go too far with that, right? So it's not just record companies it's not just money, it's also the people who end up supporting what you did in the first place. And I feel this album in time, or over time, has been proven to be a really good balance of both, like a step in an assertive step in a kind of a new direction. But then when you peel back the layers of how different it is, you see that the spirit of the band is still intact. That's exactly it.
And what we got to understand too is that after this album came out, and they came out with, I believe it was Monster next,
yeah.
They became, at that time, the largest grossing band of all time. And I believe it was like $40 million a concert or something like that, or $40 million a year. And they went from this obscure college band that were playing, you know, frat parties and garages and whatnot. And then they came in, and now they're selling out arenas. So, you know, and it was on the heels of Out of Time, Automatic for the People, and then Monster comes out, and they become this, basically a monster.
All of which sold 4 million, by the way.
Yeah, so
there's creative, you know, high peak.
And doing it their way, here's Melissa writing to the program and says, thank you, Michael Stipe and REM, for putting out this album and not selling out to bring back, and for bringing back the creative art of music. What the story brings to me is the art of listening. If managers would put out the artist's music without selling out, people will decide what they like and do not like, if people would learn to listen, not to be judged by what makes money, but by listening to the gift given by a musician's creativity. That's an interesting comment there. And James writes to the program and says, Jim says, really enjoying the conversation about one of the greatest bands of all time. From the very beginning, connecting with REM for me has been about their expressionistic approach, less about piecing the lyrics together and more about the emotive delivery of Michael Stipe's vocals. Yeah. For me, their songs are often powerful, sometimes because of the vagueness of the lyrics and the murky vocals, not in spite of them. That comes from Jim. Interesting to get that take there.
Yeah, I like that.
Jane says, REM was not the only one making introspective music at the time, though. Their friends in U2 were as well. Achtung Baby was lyrically and sonically quite divergent from the Joshua Tree. Yeah?
Right, of course. That's one of the biggest examples you can think of a band that took a wild left turn and hit the jackpot again,
but also still had the power to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, definitely had the but were risking a lot as well, and they had already taken a hit with Rattle and Hum, and I mean, when we think about bands that followed like Wilco and Radiohead, we expect risks from those bands. I mean, those bands defined their career arcs on doing things like what Automatic for the People is. I'm not saying that they were necessarily influenced. I don't know that, but there are certain artists that we can look to who we can count on to not repeat themselves. And I, you know, you have to think that's a good thing. Sometimes, you know, you get people like Neil Young who are going to, you can also guarantee they're going to put stuff out you don't like too. And Lou Reed, and you have to take those chances with some people.
Gary on Twitter says, have you given Monster a try in a while? If you're looking for standard REM, very different. It's very different than the standard REM, but the grungier element gave it a nice edge. Did you like Monster?
My favorite album.
That was your favorite REM? You like
actually, my I liked Monster, but my favorite album is Out of Time. And because one of the deeper tracks that are on there is actually considered, I think Michael Stipe had actually said that it was one of his favorite songs, which is Country Feedback. That is my all-time favorite REM song. Hmm.
And we didn't even get to discuss songs like Sweetness Follows, which cranked up.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorites.
I know we've got 10 seconds to listen to it. Why is this one of your favorites?
I just love the way the song kind of twists. It's hard to describe how it just unfolds, and the there's that. Well, I don't want to talk over it while people are listening, but
I know you want to listen. I know he's talking about readying to bury your father and your mother. I mean, this is heavy as
well. Pretty heavy stuff. It's got this like beautiful. Here it comes. Oh, it's the next part.
Beautiful.
It's just got a beautiful sort of. It's just turned slightly in the chord.
And this is one of those songs, Sabi, that you can forget was even on this. If you haven't listened to this album in 20 years, you go, oh, I knew Man on the Moon, I knew Night Swimming and Drive and all this. So one that may get lost.
Right.
Worth revisiting.
Definitely. I mean, all three of my favorite songs on this record are deep cuts.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, I have a new appreciation for the monster hits.
Sabi Reyes-Kulkarni is a music journalist. Where can people read your work, Sabi?
Pitchfork, Billboard, Spin, as you mentioned, Noisy, Bandcamp Daily. I write for Bandcamp Daily quite a bit. I also write for the Alternative News Weekly in Nashville, Nashville Scene. And I write, as you mentioned, locally in the DNC as well.
I love talking music with you. Come back sometime. That's great.
I'd love
fun.
To.
Thank you very much. And Tommy Mach, 25 years since REM dropped Automatic for the People on us. And you shared some not only great insight, but a great personal story. And I want to thank you for being willing to do that. Thanks for coming in.
I appreciate you for having me. Thank you very much.
Great stuff. All right. Well, you know when Sabi mentioned those beautiful strings that you get? This is Michael Stipe, Mike Mills, and just a little bit of strings to take us home. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you Tuesday on Member-Supported Public Radio. Deserves a quiet now.